Hello, everyone. Welcome back to episode 267 of the 8-Bit Adventures podcast. I am your host, Sean Hayes, here to bring you the latest and greatest geeky news of the week. We've got some really, really big news for indie game fans and a whole bunch of other stuff. And our deep dive today is tabletop RPGs that I think you should try, because there's not really a whole lot of great topics to go into a deep dive to. And so that's what we're doing. Hope everyone's doing well. It was reunion weekend this past weekend. And so I got to see a whole bunch of my, it was not my reunion, but a whole bunch of my friends were in town. So I went up there anyway to go see them. One of my friends that was in town was aforementioned on the podcast, Nebula Award winner Janaea Kemper, acclaimed tabletop RPG designer, and just general game designer. So it was really great to see her. I haven't seen her since my wedding. So it's been a couple years. And then some folks that I haven't seen since the last reunion 5 years ago. So it was nice. Got to do some D&D prep as well. And got a whole bunch of new shiny toys for one of my Magic the Gathering decks. We're going to talk about that in quest log, because that's going to be the goal for next week. So, point of order, there will be no podcast next week, as I will be on vacation. So there will also be no art stream on Saturday and no Stardew stream on Sunday. So just keep that in mind. We're going to be away. I was going to try and have something to put on the podcast feed for next week, but it didn't come together. So that's fine. You know, for once, it's taking a break for fun reasons and not like I have the plague and I'm dying. So there we go. All right. That said, why don't we get into this week's news? Because we got some really great stuff to talk about. All right, first up, Activision Blizzard finally formally acknowledging the creation of the QA Workers Union at Raven Software, and in a letter that Bobby Kotick sent to employees at the company, will begin negotiations. So this is a big deal. This is a big day. This is only the second union in North America for the games industry. And so the fact that it's actually now being taken seriously because it's now a legal entity, this is good news. Folks that are traditionally in contract positions, my hope is that this provides an impetus for, you know, that it carries on to the rest of the industry, because unfortunately the video games industry, and to a certain extent the board game and tabletop game industries, kind of rely on somewhat predatory practices for essentially getting labor. And so at places like Activision Blizzard, it has led to poor work environments. This is great. This is great that they'll be in negotiations for collective bargaining agreements and things like that. The system works. Next up, in sort of less Activision Blizzard news, the indie news that everybody's been asking about, Hollow Knight Silksong, will be released within the next 12 months. as its current timeline. There was not a hard release date for it, but assuming everything still continues going to schedule, and it is coming to Xbox first. And the Xbox account confirmed that it will be releasing within the next 12 months. So it was part of a showcase for new games that are coming out for Xbox. And, you know, just more of a gameplay trailer. So, yes, the end is in sight, folks. I think it's interesting that there still hasn't been a whole lot of talk about it. So my hope is that maybe when it gets closer to the release date, we'll actually see more of what's going on with it. Although they could not, I mean, honestly, at this point, they could not show anything. And I feel like they're still going to get outrageous day one sales just because of, like, when a release date drops is, I think, is going to be very telling as to what sort of orders and pre-orders we're going to see. Because the hunger is out there, and it is real, folks, for this game. Sort of jumping back to Activision Blizzard, Diablo 4 did get a release date. It is coming out next year. I don't know if there was anything further of a release date. Nope, just 2023. They announced during the Xbox and Bethesda games showcase. So a couple takeaways. It will be made with PC and consoles in mind. And that it's going to be a you purchase it, and there will be sort of freemium cosmetic stuff available after launch, and expansions available after launch. The expansions part, that's sort of normal. It seems kind of weird still for a game in which you pay to have that there, it's still paid cosmetics. You know, I know Path of Exile players are still shaking their heads and laughing for a game that is actually 100% free to play. And that the only paid features are cosmetics and like stash tabs and things like that. Also, we got a showcasing the Necromancer is returning for Diablo 4. So. You know, as more information comes out about that, we'll, you know, I'll report on it. There was, you know, basically Overwatch 2 is also set to release during that time period and will be free to play. But I kind of want to wait for the messaging on that to be solidified a little bit, because Overwatch 2 has been all over the place just want to see a firmer grasp of what the actual information on it is when it gets closer to launch. Still, you know, me personally, not playing anything until Activision Blizzard can prove that they have turned their culture around. So I'm sticking to it. But, you know, obviously, you know, I will report on what's coming out and what's happening with it. Next up, a Resident Evil Village expansion called the Winter's Expansion will be available on October 28th. This expansion includes, and there's on the graphic here for folks that are watching the VOD or live here on Twitch, there's third-person mode, which is exactly what it sounds. It turns the game into a third-person sort of action adventure game. There is more content for Mercenaries mode, including the ability to play as Lady Dimitrescu. And then a story expansion called Shadows of Rose, where you play as Rose at, you know, sometime several years down the line in the future, you know, sort of shortly, I guess, after the events depicted at the end of the game, like sort of post credits. And that will be third person, sort of. And I don't want to give spoiler, but basically struggling with sort of the powers that she has, and doing a little bit of sort of an introspection adventure. So, yeah, so that'll be available October 28th. So basically get people back into playing Resident Evil Village. And who knows, maybe we'll, I don't know if third person mode will be enough to get people to come back, but I know, the story expansion will certainly be enough. So it sounds like the rest of the stuff is just sort of extra, and possibly playing as, Lady Dimitrescu in Mercenaries mode. I think we'll attract a lot of people to come back and at least, you know, try that out once or twice. Finally, for our quick fire news, there is a survey up for Dungeons and Dragons. This is roughly about a 25 to 30 minute survey that Wizards is doing, kind of just asking people like what tools they use to play D&D, or like how they play D&D, like if it's in person, at a store, online. And sort of like what tools do you use? Like, do you use Roll20, D&D Beyond? Do you use physical books? You know, for Dungeon Masters, how much time do you spend preparing for sessions? What sort of stuff, like content, are you interested in for the game? Like what sort of campaign settings when putting stuff together for a game? What sort of content do you use? And, you know, I suspect most people are going to answer homebrew, but like, are you doing like a homebrewed version of a setting totally from scratch? Or are you taking bits and pieces of settings and sort of mashing them together? So one of the other things was like, hey, what other stuff are you playing? You know, be it tabletop RPGs or just video games. And I think this is, maybe perhaps a little bit of market research to find out, like, what sort of other things are people that play D&D interested in? And to find out, like, you know, if a sizable chunk of the audience is interested in games that kind of fit outside of the mold, what lessons can be, and this is my hope, what lessons can be learned from those games, and what sort of mechanics do they have that really engage with people? This is supposed to be an independent study that I did in college of like, what sort of mechanics do people find engaging, and using them to try and increase engagement with digital interfaces, like through the use of games. That project totally fell apart. But you know, the idea of that, I think, is still a worthwhile concept. And if this means that, you know, in the future, we get sort of a either revision for 5th edition or planning for a 6th edition of the game, you know, that maybe takes a good hard look at the history of D&D and decides, you know, maybe we expand the game to accommodate other types of games instead of just heroic fantasy, and systems to incorporate that, you know, and maybe just generalizing some of the core features to fit other modes of gameplay, you know, and this is basically sort of leaning, dancing around the, D&D as a combat game, and it's hard to do anything outside of that with it. Which, it's a complicated topic, because there is some truth to that matter. I've done a whole spiel on past episodes before on you can, because many other games sort of just use the base core feature that D&D does for non-combat stuff. You know, and it's just the question is like, you're just essentially not using a whole chunk of D&D systems, which, you know, whatever, could be fine. But yeah, so I mean, you know, I'm saying this as someone who answered like Stardew Valley, Monster Hunter, what else did I respond with that? Things that I've been playing, and it was like in the past 3 months specifically. So that was the other thing. Gosh, I was trying to think of what else I had answered with. Yeah, I honestly can't remember. But it was like other stuff. Right. Oh, Vampire Survivors. That was one. You know, I gotta throw Vampire Survivors. It was a lot of like indie games that I threw in there, actually. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I would love if enough people answer Animal Crossing and Stardew Valley and I would say, you know, if this was like 20 years ago, Harvest Moon, but like both the Harvest Moon and Story of Seasons are not in great places right now. So, yeah, it makes me wonder if we'll see a more diverse rule set for D&D that if you want to just do a game in which you just play a bunch of people who live in a town and you just want to do like a Stardew Valley Animal Crossing type game using the D&D rule set, it will accommodate that and not like that you kind of have to shoehorn heroic fantasy into that and make something with it. So yeah, I'm interested to see what comes of that survey. And it also makes me wonder if like most folks just end up answering homebrew, if we end up seeing a lot more tools put into the books about how to do really good world building and how to do world building for different types of games. Because obviously the stuff that you need to put together to do a story for a game of like intrigue and mystery is a lot different than a dungeon crawl. You know, like a dungeon crawl, you might not need to know political leaders of, you know, the surrounding communities. Whereas like a mystery and intrigue game, that should be something that you should have on hand. Whereas like you might not need to know points of interest outside of town. So, yeah, I'm really interested to see what comes of the survey. You know, oh, I mean, they also ask like, you know, how do you feel from a market standpoint, like is D&D on the rise, on the fall, is it maintaining or whatever? And, you know, I was very honest. I was like, hey, you know, D&D already has like a significant portion of the market share, like by far. And it's often to the detriment of like other indie developers, like indie game designers. So, you know, I mean, sure, if you want to do initiative, like to get more people playing D&D, I guess. But I mean, at this point, like there's more people playing D&D now than there's ever been. So, yeah, I worry that particular question leans into a sort of late stage capitalism, like it's like profit is no longer enough. Like you have to be able to show growth year over year. And if you're not showing growth while still being profitable, or even like growth, but not being profitable, like you're doing something wrong. Like that, it's just wild to me. And I guess like that's what happens when you're publicly traded, like as opposed to being a private company where you can just say like, yeah, we're profitable. That's fine. That's enough. So that survey is live right now. You can go to the Wizards website or D&D Beyond also. We'll have it as like a pop-up that shows up. Again, takes like 25 to 30 minutes to fill out. They do ask like, you know, what your experience playing D&D is and everything. So if you are somebody, you know, that even if you don't play a lot or you haven't played in a while, but kind of want to have an opinion on making the game better, I would say, or perhaps making it more accessible or making it more or having materials that are more useful to people. You know, I would recommend filling it out. Cause yeah, you know, I also think if D&D can get away from a lot of the problematic stuff that they've had in the past, and just really focus on making like a good game. And at the same time, I don't know. It's tough because like, it's one of the things where I'm of the opinion, like, you're always going to have a market leader in an industry, right? I mean, we have them in the video game industry. You know, you have like your EAs and Activisions, and you have your Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft and stuff. But like also, like getting people interested in games also opens the door for indie game developers. And I think, you know, having tools available, you know, also helps indie developers like develop games. And so I don't know, I would also love to see, more materials on like how Wizards can specifically help third party or indie devs. I mean, it would specifically be for D&D because like, that's what they're going to do. Like they're not going to help competition, but in such a way, like, I don't know. I would love to see advice. Like if Wizards were to put out a book for how to do like a homebrew world and have a lot of the advice be applicable to all sorts of games outside D&D, like, I think that just helps everybody, you know? I think, personally. But, you know, I would love to see, like, as much as I love D&D, I would also love to see, you know, other games succeed in the space, too. And I think there's room, there's a lot of room, I think. You know, tabletop RPGs are kind of bigger than ever. And I think there's plenty of room for, you know, both big behemoths and indie devs. You know, I would love to see it reach a space like we are with the video games industry. You know, where you can have indie, you know, either fully independent, like Concerned Ape on Stardew Valley, or you have, you know, indie developers who, you know, are able to make really good products and then work with a publisher who helps publish stuff, and does so ethically. You know, I would love to see the industry get moved in that direction, because far too often it's the case where people put stuff out and they don't give themselves enough respect, where they spend so much time working on a product and then they're like, and this is free, you know, which like, if that's their prerogative, then fine. But also, I mean, for me personally, I would think that I'd want to be paid for my labor. So, all right, before I get too far on that tangent, speaking of tabletop RPGs, here are some that I think are worth trying. And I have my own biases, so I'm going to explain, you know, these are kind of suited to my tastes, but I'll explain why, and why I think they're worth checking out. Okay. Tabletop RPGs that I think everyone should try. So for D&D fans or Pathfinder fans or just fans of heroic fantasy, I think taking a look at Quest is worthwhile. So Quest is a sort of lighter, more narrative driven RPG that, you know, very clearly inspired by a lot of heroic fantasy a staple, you know, existing RPGs, but kind of streamlines it a lot and makes it a lot more narrative and kind of seeks to take out a lot of the more problematic elements. You know, and kind of present it in such a way. So for people who aren't interested in like super crunchy tactical kind of stuff, you know, or certainly maybe for like younger kids, you know, this is an option. It's a much lighter book. And I think it's around like $20, as compared to like the $50 you would spend for, like a print D&D book. Although I don't know if the $20 is for the PDF or the print version of that, of Quest. I'll look that up while still explaining. So, you still have some of the same, archetypes where, you know, you make a character, your character sheet is more just like a card and you don't have stats, right? You have, sort of your role, which is sort of like your class. And then it's, you have like a couple powers that are, from your role. You know, and then, the rest of your sheet is just like stuff about you. It's not like, oh, well, I have, like these six stats and then I have a bunch of these skills and all these modifiers and everything. The way that Quest operates is you just kind of, you know, collaboratively tell a story. And then if there's something that you think might require a die roll, you go ahead and roll the die, but you don't really apply any modifiers to it. And basically how the die comes up determines, you know, whether something favorable or unfavorable happens. But it's generally just assumed that, like, unless you think a die roll should determine the outcome, you kind of just can assume you do it. Or if you decide that, you know, maybe you decide that your character should struggle with something, you can just narrate that. I mean, there's not, you know, you don't use weapon dice or anything like that. I mean, as far as like, you know, monsters go, monster design is sort of relatively streamlined to where, you know, generally they only take a couple hits, if you're going to fight them, and they might have like one or two powers, if necessary. So it's really focused on sort of like streamlining a lot of the combat stuff. It does not assume that you're going to use a map and minis and everything. Range and movement is kind of done by like zones. And even then it's sort of like, you know, if you're next to somebody, if you're far enough away that like you could move to be next to them, next turn, if you're, you know, farther than that and like you're in like weapon range, or if you're just too far away and like, that's it. So yeah. And then, you know, a lot of the powers, you know, what there's, it's a good mix, I think, of stuff that can be used, and even like the stuff that's very clearly done as like a quote unquote combat power. You know, there are uses for them in like exploration or in social scenes as well. And I think, you know, it was really trying to lean into having everybody be able to do cool stuff that fits within the theme of your archetype or your role. And not just being like, yeah, I'm just the guy that goes around and hit things and that's all I do. Or conversely, like, you know, I'm just a character that just does all social stuff, but like I can't fight. But also, like, it doesn't assume Like, this is a game where you could run it and never have to, you know, like, you could just run it as a social game. You know, and a lot of, like, the treasure is, you know, very flavorful and whimsical. And then progression is just, like, at the end of each session, you just get a new power. So, all right, so let's see, we're gonna look at the, okay, so the print book is $40, okay, so it is a little bit cheaper than a D&D book, than, like, the Player's Handbook, but, with this, everything you need, I believe should be in that book. Yeah. And because, like, designing sort of NPCs and monsters is much more streamlined, certainly a lot more than D&D, you know, like, they do have, like, a treasure book and a character book and stuff. Not necessary. You know, it those do feel like add-ons, as opposed to, you know, with D&D, you kind of need the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual. Although it says here the digital game book is $0. What is... is it actually free? That's interesting. Huh. Yeah, I would say, yeah. Yeah, I guess the PDF version's free. That I'm not sure. I also don't know if it's, like, detecting that I already bought it, and therefore it would just be re-downloading it. But yeah. I think it's a nice, if you're looking for sort of D&D fare, or heroic fantasy, but you don't really want to deal with the level of crunch that, say, Dungeons and Dragons or Pathfinder have, I think this might be, you know, a good choice. Next up, speaking of narrative games, this one's dear to my heart, Seventh Sea. So Seventh Sea is an Age of Sail fantasy game. That is set in a, I guess it's very clearly modeled after Earth. But, like, they sort of redefine a lot of the nations and introduce, like, there is magic. So it's sort of like an Age of Sail historical fantasy, but, like, also throwing a twist on a lot of the nations that are present at the time period. So that right off the bat, super interested in. I love the setting. I had the Seventh Sea CCG when it was in print. So specifically I have, the second edition rulebook. Again, it's also a very narrative game. It's stuff where, you have, you know, you do have, like, dots in stats. And I can't remember if that affects, like, number of dice you roll, or if it's just a bonus to things. But a lot of it is very narrative in the sense that, like, when you do things, you can essentially, like, bargain with the GM to get bonuses or to take failures in order to get benefits, like, later on. And, you know, and uses hero points to, like, basically just automatically do things and narratively do things. Instead of hit points, it has a sort of wound system. So fans of White Wolf, that might sound familiar. You have basically a wound track. But at certain benchmarks, you have what are known as dramatic wounds. Dramatic wounds can only be removed like when you fully rest, as opposed to like when you take a quick breather, like you recover all standard wounds, but dramatic wounds remain. And they actually apply both penalties and bonuses, depending on the level, to essentially make things riskier and more exciting. so I really love that as a mechanic. It's a classless system. So it's free, it's very free form, in that you just sort of pick perks and skills that might go really well with your character. And how advancement happens is if you advance your character's story, which I love, like your character has goals. And if you advance your goals, essentially you get like points to apply to new abilities. And it's just, you know, like it assumes that you get a ship at some point and your ship, like advances in rank based on the number of adventures it goes on, as opposed to like if certain criteria is met, essentially it's achievements. Like it has an achievement system, but achievements unlock abilities for your ship. So it's like if you survive a cannon fire, like a cannonade, which nearly kills your ship, but you somehow survive, like, you know, when that adventure is concluded, like you get this achievement that then applies benefits to your ship. The magic system is like essentially various nations have their own forms of magic that is practiced. It's locked to members of that nation. And it's very heavily tied in with the lore of that nation. So, for example, you know, folks from Avalon essentially channel. It's like with sort of fey bargains, channel the knights of old. And so you sort of channel like Arthurian knights and you become essentially an avatar of that knight's legend, and therefore gain benefits to that. Montane sorcerers practice like blood magic, which allows them to teleport. Ison practitioners use like hexen work, which is you're basically a witcher. You make all sorts of like grisly potions and stuff. That it has a sidebar that says like, hey, here's a warning. A lot of the components for this stuff get kind of borders on villainy, and for the squeamish, like you might want to just pass up this section altogether, because it does delve in, you know, certain practices that are frowned upon in modern day society on Earth. Namely, you know, it's like utilizing corpses and components of corpses for these potions and things. But you do that specifically like, to fight monsters. Things like that. It has really great flavor and great world building. And my aforementioned friend, Jonea worked on a whole bunch of books for them. Yeah, I would definitely recommend picking these up. You can get them in print or in digital. You know, they are, it's not an indie dev game. So these are sort of, you know, full price in the $40-$50 book range. Or perhaps even $50-$60 book range. There's a lot of books. I think they're worth it. I just have the core rule book, but I have a bunch of PDFs that I picked up on DriveThruRPG that just really go like there's the Pirate Nations, which are sort of just like all the different pirate factions based out of what is their version of the Caribbean. And like the pirate factions have their own form of magic where, like, you basically form a charter, and as long as you follow the code and the rules that you put forth in your charter, you are lucky, and anyone that breaks that pact is marked with the black spot and is cursed. I think it's so cool. There's just so many elements that are great. I think, you know, the developers feel like, to me, they did a great job at trying to respect and appreciate other cultures that are trying to be represented in the various books. Something that is kind of lacking in a lot of games that seek to build, like, a full game world, you know, and do it outside of just medieval European fantasy. We've seen a lot of attempts with doing it, like, with D&D that have fallen short historically. Yeah, you know, they do a great job with all of the worlds of or all the nations of Thea. And the Seventh Sea is like a sort of mystical otherworldly realm. that, like, there's like a whole bunch of various seas. And then there's, like, the Sixth Sea is, like, you know, almost like an elemental plane of existence. And then the Seventh Sea is almost like the astral sea, sort of a thing. Like, nobody really knows what's there, because you have to go through, like, a sea of fire to get there. So yeah, I'm super stoked about it. I wish more people would play it, so that way, like, I could have a chance to actually get to play it. I've only gotten to play it once, in college. Loved it, and would love to jump back in. And you should too. Next up, Cortex. Cortex is, I basically know of it through, they kind of, sort of did a big, almost a revamp of their rules, and basically put it out as a system for building tabletop RPG games, and as a very modular system. So its base system, essentially, the idea is, when putting together your character, you use generally around two different methods for building a dice pool. And when you roll dice, you pick two of those dice, and that determines, like, whether you succeed or fail. So, like, no matter how many dice you end up adding into the pool, you generally just pick your two best dice. And so the idea is, like, you know, applying different skills and different, like, situational modifiers and everything, it just builds your dice pool up to give you better odds of rolling good numbers. And then there's, like, all sorts of modules that they have in the book for building out, like, different types of games. So, like, you could make heroic fantasy, you could make a superhero game, you could just make a soap opera game, you know, where your traits, like, so what your stats and skills would be in, like, a D&D style game are just, like, the relationships that you have with other people and maybe, like, your values. So you have, like, a bunch of, like, you know, core values, and then you apply them to, like, your relationships with other people, and that's your dice pool. And, like, you just, and it's all just interpersonal stuff. And then you can spend plot points to fuel, like, special abilities. And these might be, you know, very mundane, like, you're an investigative journalist. So, like, you spend a plot point to just, like, gain access to an area that might normally be off limits to do some investigative journalism. To, like, utterly, like, you spend a plot point instead to do pyrokinesis in, like, a superhero game. This is the system that I know for a while Into the Motherlands was using. I believe the RPG that they're putting out is based on like uses Cortex as a base system. And it's also like, so kind of unlike, D&D's current iteration, Cortex is designed to help people come up with their own games. And I think that's cool. That it's really just like a whole system of modules, to, you know, let you apply sort of any number of them at your leisure to kind of build the game that you want. There's definitely things that like I've looked at when thinking of stuff that I want to do. And it's like there is a module for doing like hit points. But alternatively, you could do it as stress. And instead, stress is just dice that get like bad dice that get added to your dice pool that are just like it's dice that get added that are designed to try and mess up your dice pool. So definitely recommend checking that out. Especially if you're into sort of the development side, like game dev side of things. And they include like a couple different sort of base, what's the right word? I guess games that use Cortex right in the core book. You know, one of which is like a, you are, an environmental like disaster response team. And so, like you're going in and, like it's not you're fighting monsters or anything. It's like you're just going in to rescue people from hazards. It's like you're essentially FEMA, but like it's like if instead of a mercenary group to fight like a counter-terrorist mercenary group, G.I. Joe was like sort of an independent FEMA organization. Like FEMA and Coast Guard that will like go in and like rescue people from environmental disasters, and provide like medical aid and support. So, I mean, you know, and that's interesting. And finally, this would not be an 8-bit adventure stream if I didn't try and plug some sort of fishing game. So the last one up is Rod, Reel, and Fist. This is an indie RPG. It was on Kickstarter, funded in 24 hours. this is super light. Uses everything with like 2d6, very light on stats and stuff. But it's essentially a lot of their base sort of stories are set in like 1980s Japan. And it's essentially some sort of calamity has fallen, or will fall. And in order to avert that calamity, you and your friends must go out in search of some sort of legendary fish, to receive its blessing or to do something with it that will help you avert that calamity. And like, that's the system. And this is designed around like, so there is combat and a sense of, you know, you go back and forth, like fighting a thing, but the combat is fishing, to a certain extent. There's also animal combat. So there are non-fish animals that might show up, like bears, and that, you know, you might have to drive them off, or get away. And the idea being that, like, you're here to fish and there's stuff that, like, might come try and mess up your fishing trip. And therefore, like, you gotta shoo them away. How it handles, like, it doesn't do health or hit points or anything like that. It uses a stress and fatigue set of mechanics where essentially, stress and fatigue just apply static penalty, like stacking penalties to your die rolls. Whereas stress is like temporary for that particular reeling in of a fish or fighting off of an animal, whereas fatigue, like, it lasts until you take a rest. The idea being that, like, at a certain point, you just might get so stressed out and tired that you gotta hoof it back to base camp and just call in a day. I'm so thankful that one of my players and folks that have watched Tales of Jamora, Matt Tucker, one of my dear friends, told me about this and then sent me the PDF. Shared the PDF with me. As far as I can tell, I don't believe. Oh no, I do think they have a soft cover version. This is something that I'm looking at getting in print myself. Because it is Fishing Minigame the RPG. It's everything I've ever wanted, folks. It is in my wheelhouse. And it's a great name, because like obviously Rod Reel, applies to like the main idea of the game is like that you spend your day like fishing, and a lot of the abilities revolve around like doing interesting things with fishing. And then the fist portion is like, sometimes you might just need to fight off a bear and there are certain things that let you help do that too. And like looking through the mechanic, it's like, it's very easy to pick up. It's a much lighter RPG than Dungeons and Dragons. And like, if you play that, like, this will be super easy to wrap your brain around. But even like, it's pretty comparable in terms of complexity to something like Powered by the Apocalypse, which is known for being very, like new to RPGs friendly. So I would highly recommend pick this up. Let me see what the price is on DriveThruRPG, which I think is the only place you can get it. So the PDF is $13. The soft cover book is $35, which is a little pricey in my opinion, but it is an indie developer. They did it on Kickstarter. Wizards of the Coast was selling soft cover RPGs for D&D 3rd edition, which was, like 20 years ago at like $20-$25. So factoring in the price of inflation, like probably not that bad. Suitable for all ages. Failures are temporary setbacks. It can be scaled up. And you can do it as a space opera, martial arts odyssey, cyberpunk adventure. And it essentially uses you use dice, but there's also a method of like a rock, paper, scissors type system of, figuring out how to get an advantage on the animal or fish that you're trying to defeat. And there are other things like pieces of gear that give you bonuses and stuff. Something that I didn't dive into, but they mention in the listing is, they come with 6 scenarios, including an introductory sandbox, a tournament, a fishing journey, a time loop, a tower defense minigame where the players must protect their town against hundreds of eels, and a roguelike mode, which expands the game by adding an evolving adventuring region to which the players must return multiple times in order to fully conquer it. And apparently rules for splicing it into your existing game. I did not realize it has that. That's great. That's another thing that I would love. I love when indie developers like have a system that's fairly light and say like, hey, you're playing some other game. Here's how to make this work. Like here's how to, slip this in. If you want to do this as like a one-off session or something. And it's called Beach Episode Compatible. This is great. I love it. This is everything. And I have it, but it's like, I am interested in getting the print version, because there's a certain, you know, I love having physical copies of things that I really enjoy on my shelf to peruse. And, you know, the art style, you know, is an anime art style, which very much fits with sort of the overall theme of this. And like it is a really great sort of representation on minigame mechanics for fishing. So that is going to be my final tabletop RPG recommendation for this episode. To recap, we've got Ride Reel and Fist, Cortex, Seventh Sea, and Quest. So highly recommend all of those. You know, being 8-bit adventures and just loving our fish, I would recommend starting with Rod, Reel, and Fist. This is again, I will, like, I will absolutely force people to play this game until I get a chance to play it. This is a game I really want to play so badly. But the problem is, I'm probably the only person that would be willing to run it. So, all right, we're going to move on from that and do kind of a quick quest log. So here we go. Quest log is where I talk about what sort of geeky stuff was on my to-do list for last week and what sort of geeky stuff I want to put to do on my to-do list for this week. Words, I can do them. So last week was selecting art for the character page for the 8-Bit Adventures comic book. I'm happy to say that the character page is all done. It's finished. I got to tweak some of the dialogue, or not dialogue, but like character descriptions, but like placeholder descriptions are in there. It does its job. It's just like finding out what might be more interesting to talk about with the characters. Character names are in there. Art's in there. The whole section, it's done. It's good to go. And then played Monster Hunter Rise. I played Monster Hunter Rise. I did some stuff. I did a, just a couple event quests here and there, but also there was one. It was against, it was against a basil juice and we failed. I brought in a bunch of randos. People couldn't handle it. We failed that quest and I said, I'm done. I'm done for the evening. I'm still ultimately it's not on the plan for this week because I'm going on vacation, but the ultimate goal is I gotta get to HR 100 before Sunbreak comes out. Because oh boy, there's that vampire dragon they're doing as the flagship monster for that has some wild abilities. So I gotta make sure that I'm at the top of my game and am able to take out whatever variant Valstrax is the final boss in Monster Hunter Rise. So I did both of those. Got everything done on my list. This week, because I'm going to be on vacation, the goal is I want to play a Magic Gathering Commander with my brother. and see who else we can con into playing Commander. So if you don't know, Commander is a casual format where you make 100 card decks. And you set aside one card as your commander. Your commander determines the type of colors you can use in your magic deck. And it gets put in a special zone that you can cast it from. So this means that like you don't have to go fishing through your deck to get your special card. I have essentially Dungeons and Dragons dungeon deck that I have been tinkering with some help from some of the DMs at Purple Dragon. It's a weird deck. It is not the typical dungeon deck that people run, but I wanted to have it be green, white, blue, as opposed to white, blue, black, because one, I like playing green, and two, I have a whole bunch of the really good green dungeon cards, including the Planeswalker pictured here, Eliwick Tumblestrom, which is a character used in a bunch of what do they call it? Actual plays, live plays, or whatever, actual play campaigns or shows. So yeah, just gonna play Commander. That's my goal. So we'll see. And also, you know, fine tune some of the other decks that I have. I've got like 7 Commander decks. And then, you know, probably cataloging more of my collection. Ran out of boxes. So stuff just has to stay in the boxes they're in. So, all right. That is it for this episode of the 8-Bit Adventures podcast. Thank you all for joining me for this episode. As I said, there will be no podcast next week. But thank you for your support. If you want to see more content from 8-Bit Adventures, including the podcast, my comics, artwork, and all that stuff, check out 8-BitAdventures.com. If you would like to help support that, the best place to do that is over on Patreon. At patreon.com/8BitAdventures, you can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And that gives you early access to comics, patron-exclusive comics, and for $2 patrons, behind-the-scenes content. Namely for like D&D playtest type stuff. We also have some patron-exclusive channels in the Discord server. The link to that, there is an invite link to that in the show notes, in the podcast description. And finally, our opening theme is One Up by Professor Shy Guy. You can find his work over at professorshyguy.bandcamp.com. So big shout out. Thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you to Professor Shy Guy. And with that, we're done. So as always, thank you all for listening. Have fun, happy gaming, and enjoy your pie cake.